Up next on Radio Days, the podcast.
Lanny Reneke would put steel wool down in a trumpet and squirt lighter fluid all over the steel wool, set it on fire, and play it into a Shure. You know that old microphone? It looked like you could drive nails with this thing.
Wow.
And then put it on the mic stand and sing into it. But he's playing. This thing is on fire.
Greetings and salutations, and welcome to Radio Days, a podcast radio program that delves into the world of terrestrial radio. It's DJs and on-air personality, and you, all fans of radio as a medium. Here's your host, Ron.
Hello and welcome to Radio Days, the podcast, not only offering this audio podcast for your enjoyment, but also you can now watch this podcast via YouTube, and you can watch it as well at ronrobinsonstudios.com on YouTube, and at ronrobinsonstudios.com, as I mentioned, is where you can see this podcast. This week, very excited about this guest, very big name, an original member of the legendary rock band Grand Funk Railroad. Mr. Mark Farner is joining us today. This first segment, in fact, of this podcast is sponsored. I don't know what kind of accent that is. Sponsored by the Linda Ray team. And to tell us more about her team and how they can help you in these uncertain times in the real estate world, here is Linda Ray herself. Hey, Linda, how you doing?
Hey, Ron, I'm doing well. Listen, I'm kind of anxious to hear your new guests and what they have to say today. So,
good stuff.
The Linda Ray team has a really proven track record over the last 40 years. And it's just amazing how we can maximize your profit on your home. And I think the main thing is also to teach it like family and make it go smooth. We have tons and tons of real live testimonials on our website at lindarayteam.com. Please check it out. And if you have any questions, call me. You can call me at 248-709-3786. Or easier, just Google the Linda Ray team. It's everywhere, social media. So again, if you're thinking about making a move, whether it's in-state or out, we have people networking agents in place in different states as well to take care of your business in that state, as well as we take care of you here in Michigan. Thank you for your business.
Does it cost anything to ask a question? Get a hold of Linda Ray. Thanks, Linda. We'll talk to you soon. You take care. Hello and welcome to Radio Days, the podcast, not only offering this audio podcast for your enjoyment, but now you can watch this show via YouTube and, of course, at ronrobinsonstudios.com. This week, I welcome, you're not going to believe this, I'm very excited about my guest today, one of the original members of the legendary rock band Grand Funk Railroad. Mr. Mark Farner will be joining us today. But before we welcome in Mark, I want to share, again, why I produce this podcast, plain and simple. It's to promote the upcoming documentary about the history of radio. And if you want to know more about Radio Days, 101 Years of Radio, that's Radio Days with a Z, 101 Years of Radio, info can be found at ronrobinsonstudios.com. Along with Don Brewer and Mel Schaefer, I know I'm mispronouncing Mel's last name, but Mark can strip me straight. My guest today started an American band out of Flint. You like that pun? Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome, I am your captain himself, Mr. Mark Farner. Thank you so much for joining me on this podcast. How are you, sir?
I'm just proud to be sucking air today, Ron. And it's the and Mel's last name is pronounced Shocker.
Shocker.
Like, you know, yeah, if you stuck your fingers in a light socket, you'd get a shocker.
That makes sense. I can get behind that. I get behind that. Well, listen, before we get into too much of this interview, I did mention that I did have somebody record something for the show. And if you don't mind, I'm going to go ahead and play it, and I want to get your thoughts afterwards. Because, you know, I'm a big fan of musicians, and normally I have, you know, radio personalities on the show. But, you know, I love having musicians on here. And we have a mutual friend, Brian Pastore, who wanted me to add this and have this play. Here, check this out.
Hi, Ron. I'm so excited you're doing this interview with Mark Farner. He's a dear friend. You know, I first saw Mark back in 1974 at Cobo Hall when I was in high school. And just seeing Grand Funk live was an amazing experience. And it was life-changing for me. And years later, in 1985, when our band Adrenaline was happening, we did a big show called Guitar Army. And we had a lot of the Michigan legends play on that show, and Mark was the headliner. And Chad Smith from the Red Hot Chili Peppers and myself were the core drummers for the Guitar Army. And that's when I first met Mark Farner, and it was incredible. He was just so inspiring, such a great guy. And we had an unbelievable show that at the Guitar Army that at Harpo's. And and then a few years later, I myself and a couple of the guys in our Adrenaline band, we toured with Mark. And we did a year and a half touring with him. And it was just an amazing experience doing the Christian music and meeting people, doing, you know, meet and greets after the shows and just seeing the response from the people who just were so into his music and his lyrics and his message. And I love Mark Farner. He's a dear friend, and just happy to see that this is happening. God bless you, Mark. Love you, man.
Mark, what does it mean to you to have such an impact on other musicians? That has to be unbelievable, a great feeling, no?
It is, and it's, I think it's because we have the same heart for Jesus Christ. We're not ashamed of being a Christian. You know, I'm Christian. I'm a cussing Christian. I might not fit into your church, but I fit in with brothers and sisters who confess Christ as our Redeemer, and we know where we're going when we leave this bone suit. I've already visited when I had my pacemaker put in, brother, and I left this body for a while. And I was satisfied. Even at that time, Ron, our son Jesse was still alive. I had that responsibility. He was quadriplegic on life support, lived here in the house with us. And, you know, you got grandkids, you got great-grandkids, you got a lot of responsibilities in this world. But as soon as you leave the bone suit, dude, it's like, oh, my God. I am home, and it's like I was back where I started from. Before I came to this planet, I was in that spot. And you talk about a life-changing experience. It taught me, on my re-entry into this bone suit, I was shown that debt, D-E-B-T, that four-letter word, that damn four-letter word, D-E-B-T is the worst condition for the mind. Any kind of debt, and there's all kinds of debt, not just financial debt. You know,
spiritual debt, for sure.
Right, and if you don't fulfill expectations of people and they put you on the poo-poo list, or even if you hold some kind of, you're holding yourself in regret, that's another form of debt. There's all forms of debt, but they are accumulative in their nature, and they put a weight on you. It's so gradual that you can't just say, oh, it's that one, throw that off. I have to pray to the Spirit every morning, man, before I slip my feet out onto the floor. Lord, please show me where that anchor is so I can take these bolt cutters to the chain and boom, you know.
I love that you call it a bone suit. I'm going to start using that. I'm stealing that from you, the bone suit.
Yeah, man.
You know, we of course, I Am Your Captain, Closer to Home, American Band. There's a plethora of music that came from Grand Funk Railroad. You have so much music out there, and there's a lot to cover today about your career. But I'm one who starts at the beginning. I want to go back to the earliest memories of listening to the radio. What were you listening to on the radio when you were growing up in Flint?
I was listening to WTAC, Bob Dell. I was listening to WTRX and WAMM. But CKLW, Rosalie Trombley, God bless her heart, from across the river in Windsor, Ontario, was booming this Motown music and all of the R&B that we were dancing to. And my sister and I love to dance. We go to these dances. Back then, you know, all the DJs would put on a dance on the weekend. And sometimes they'd have a band, sometimes they wouldn't. We just dance. And when they had a dance contest, Diane and I always got out and did our stuff. And a lot of times we won the contest because we danced together. My mother showed us how to do it, and we just coordinated. You know, I think it's blood.
Right, right. Well, what were some of the big name bands? Because when I think of Grand Funk Railroad, you guys were original. I mean, you guys were formed in the late 60s. You had a lot of your success in the 70s. But, I mean, you guys were an original band. What were some of the bands that really, oh, my gosh, that's what I want to do?
Well, Hendrix, as far as guitar players, Hendrix was my guy. You know, there was nobody else that could do what he could do with the guitar. I mean, he made that thing cry. He made it sing. He made it laugh. He made it speak. And nobody, and as many people that try to imitate him, nobody even comes close. I mean, you know, he's the dude. As far as guitar players, I love Jeff Beck, man. I mean,
lost him. That's too bad.
Yeah, God rest his soul. We saw the Yardbirds at the IMA Auditorium in Flint, Michigan, as the Pack. We were Terry Knight and the Pack, but the Pack was standing side stage. We had these passes to get in, and we are on the side of the stage up there watching, and Jeff Beck lays his guitar down on the side. He's got a Telecaster, and he stands it on its edge, he stands it on the edge, and he gets back, and he's taking his arms, and he's going like, ooh, like this, and he's got this thing turned up to 20. You know, it's just like feeding back and distorting. It's like vibrating and going up, and he's doing like this, and I said, oh, man, there's a showman right there, and I loved the way his style, and I loved, early on, Fresh Cream, Eric Clapton, that sound they had on Fresh Cream, his guitar was awesome. It sounded great, and then he changed it, and I went, what happened, man? They lost me, but Fresh Cream was a great album. It influenced me, the Yardbirds, of course, the Stones, the Beatles, but, we were doing that before I was writing music. We were doing all those as we were going out and, as a band. We were the Mojo and the Nightwalkers. We lived in Genesee County, so we were the Geneseans at one time. We were the Derelicts at another time. Robin in the Hoods at another time.
Well, let's start at the beginning. Tell me about Terry. Tell me about Terry Knight and the Pack.
Well, Terry Knight and the Pack... The bass player got drafted. Herman Jackson was drafted, and I got the call from Kurt Johnson, who was a guitar player for Terry Knight, and he said, well, Herm's got drafted, and we need a bass player. Can you play bass? I said, I think I can. I played the tuba. In school, I started in fifth grade. I was a tuba player, so I said bass ought to come pretty good, you know, quick to me. And I went and bought a bass and started playing bass with Terry Knight and the Pack. I had left Dick Wagner's Bossman to go do this gig, and Dick Wagner, God rest his soul, you know, he guitar player for Alice Cooper and Ursa Majors and the Frost in Michigan, great guitar player and one that showed me a lot and a lot of instruction from him. But I played with Terry Knight as a bass player and singer. And after a while, Brewer and I got together and were saying, this guy can't really sing. The only thing he can really do well is he talks to people. He can get a hold of the audience and really, you know, lead them along the path. But he's not singing. The background singers are better than he is. Let's get rid of him. And that's you know, at that time, we told him, we're going to start our own band and you're on your own. And that's when he went to New York City, moved to New York City. Don Brewer kept in touch with him. Back then there was no cell phones, there was no computers, so on the phone with him back and forth. And then Don came to me one day and said, you know, I've been in touch with Terry Knight, and he's got some contacts in New York City. He's got He's got some gigs for us. If we can, form this band. I had told him we needed to form a three-piece because the former band we were in was like a five-piece. I was a stand-up singer in the pack at that point, and there was a guitar player, Kenny Rich, from Windsor, Ontario. Craig Frost was on keyboards, Rod Lester on bass, Don Brewer on drums.
And now, at that time, I'm sorry to interrupt, but at that time, did you prefer to play the guitar or did you enjoy playing the bass in a band? What was your...
I liked playing the bass, but we needed a guitar player when it was three-piece, and that's what I wrote most of my music on. I wrote 92% of the Grand Funk catalog, and a lot of that, the majority of the songs were written on guitar, some on keyboards as well, but the majority on guitar. I did, however, love playing bass. I do like demos here at the house, I got a bass. I put the bass on and put the electronic drums on, and I can get her done.
Speaking of get her done, after I think it was Terry Knight in the pack, you were in a couple different bands before Grand Funk, but you were in the Boss Men, the Fabulous Pack. Talk about those little cups of coffee that you had with those bands.
Well, the Boss Men, Dick Wagner was the songwriter. They'd doing a lot of original stuff, and they would do some cover tunes. But Lanny Reneke on bass, Pete Woodman on drums, and Warren Keith on piano. And Warren Keith eventually played for Hank Jr. down in Nashville and toured with him after he left the Boss Men. But it was a show band. Lanny Reneke would put steel wool down in a trumpet and squirt lighter fluid all over the steel wool, set it on fire, and play it into a Shure. You know that old microphone? It looked like you could drive nails with this thing.
Wow.
And then put it on the mic stand and sing into it. But he's playing. This thing is on fire. He walks over, and Warren Keith is playing the piano, kind of like Jerry Lee Lewis would do, and he'd get down, lay on his back, and reach up and just play. But Lanny Reneke one night went over with his lighter fluid and squirted up down the keys up, and lit that thing on fire. And they were plastic, dude. They were plastic, and they melted together. And oh man, Warren Keith was so pissed. But that's the way it was. It was a show band. Everybody, when it came to making a show. Pete Woodman is back there. He's changing hats four or five times during the song. He's changing hats. He's got all the Mexican sombrero that would just about engulf his body. And, wow. Golf hat and a baseball hat. And and his girlfriend's back there handing him the hats. Is changed. Yeah. It was lovely. I loved that band because of the action. There was a lot of emotion on the stage. And one night, Dick Wagner, we got back to his apartment in Saginaw, Michigan. His kids and his wife were sleeping, of course. It's like 3 o'clock in the morning. And we played our electric guitars not plugged in. If you don't plug an electric in, they're just really soft. Right. So we're playing. He's showing me some chord inversions. And I come out and I ask him, Ron, I said, how do you write all these songs, man? Where do they come from? And he reaches over and he touches me right here in the chest. He said, they come from right in there. And I looked at him. I looked at his finger. I'm thinking, in here? He says, yeah, man, they're in you. He says, you can write music. I said, I can? So when he went to bed, I stayed up. And I was so inspired because one of my guitar heroes, Dick Wagner, told me I could write a song.
Wow.
I wrote Heartbreaker that night, which is on the first album.
Wow.
And Dick helped me finish it in the morning as far as arrangement. I had the parts, and he said, well, yeah, you need to put the chorus here and a verse here. And yeah. So that was how I got started writing songs, man. That was a big one.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. So let's move forward. Let's talk about the genesis of Grand Funk Railroad. How did you three guys get together? Because it started out as a three-piece, which Yeah. Back then wasn't that uncommon. But how did you guys get started in Grand Funk? And I also, as a second question, how did you guys come up with the name Grand Funk Railroad? Because that's a cool name.
Well, we got started when the band, the Pack, was out in Boston area. We were doing some gigs, and we thought they were promotional run. They told us, if you go out and do a few of these gigs, then we can go back and make money. We didn't know that we were actually getting paid for them. Then the guy that was out there handling where we were playing, he was getting the money, and he would buy groceries. We didn't know we were getting any money. And we were staying in summer cabins on Cape Cod on the beach. Michigan boys, first time we ever saw the ocean. So we had collected all these starfish and shells and all the things we're going to take home. And we got them stacked up in the crawl space underneath these cottages. And then the worst snowstorm in the history of the world hits the East Coast, socks us in. We're stranded. Those crawl space, they flooded. The pipes froze. There was no running water. The only thing we did have was natural gas, which we huddled around the kitchen stove because that's the only thing we had for a source of heat. We had a little space heater in the front room that was like hung on the wall, but part of us were in the kitchen, part of us were in the front room around that. I mean, it was bad. We had oatmeal for the last week that we were there. We had oatmeal, and we had to melt down the snow from outside. Of course, we had no flushing toilet. What are you going to flush it with, snow? And it's froze. The pipes are froze. We had a chair with no bottom in it, and we put a plastic liner in a grocery bag and used that to do our...
Oh, my.
Yeah, man. And then roll it up and take it out and bury it in the snowbanks. And hope you didn't run into the guy before you, as you're digging. It was bad. Don Brewer's mother, once we got the guy at the general store up there to allow Don to make a phone call, a collect call to his mother, she, Western Union, some cash up to a drugstore up the coast, and we hitchhiked across the bridge and up the coast to this drugstore, Don and I did, and got the money and got a van and got our equipment together, got the guys out of there. But that was, you know, was no communication. The two guys that were married, their wives thought they were dead. I mean, it's, we were gone, you know, you go on that many days and no communication. So they had to quit the band. The guitar player and the keyboard player. It was Craig Frost and Kenny Rich. They both quit. And the bass player, he had another gig to go off and do. And it was just Don and I standing there. I said, dude, we need to make a three-piece band. And they can't have a wife. No girlfriends even. We want them dedicated to the band. You know, we didn't want the women killing our band.
Like Yoko, right?
Yeah. So we got Mel Shocker as we were up. We were going to give this Delta Promotions a piece of our mind and find out what happened to the money that we made that they told us we weren't making. Anyway, we're in the outer office there in a waiting room. And part of the facility up there in Bay City was this rehearsal hall. And we could hear whoever it was on the other side of the wall was rehearsing. You could hear the bass coming through and the kick drum, and you know, but you couldn't, that's about all you could hear. But I looked over at Brewer and I said, whoever that bass player is, man, he says, yeah, man, he's playing his ass off. So when they took a break, lo and behold, Mel Shocker stepped out, and I goes, oh my God, it's Mel Shocker. And I'd gone to school with Mel.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we rode dirt bikes together. We smoked pot together back when it was illegal in this state. We did everything together as young guys coming up. And I asked him, I said, would you be interested in being bass player in a three-piece group that Don and I are starting? We didn't know it was Grand Funk at that point because Terry Knight hadn't entered the picture yet. But he said, yeah, man, three piece with you guys, that sounds great. When do we start? Because he had just gone through a thing with Question Mark and the Mysterians, who he was rehearsing with that day. And they weren't liking him very well for something. I think he wrecked the van or something, and they were pissed at him. So anyway, we start rehearsal at the Flint Federation of Musicians the following week, and Frank Geyer would come out and say, you boys, turn that down. I can't even hear the phones ringing in here. But that's where a lot of the music for the first album was written, right there at the Union Hall, Flint, Michigan. And then when Don Brewer brought to the table that he'd been in contact with Terry Knight, Terry Knight comes to Michigan to hear us. He loves what he's hearing. And he says, why don't you guys call your band The Name of My Song, which is, you know, Grand Funk Railroad. It was taken from an actual railway system that runs from Canada, Ontario, down through Michigan and Ohio, called Grand Trunk and Western. So we thought, oh yeah, that's a cool name. And that's the only thing we got to keep when we were suing Terry Knight and he was suing us, and we got that big standoff in the end. But we got the right to use the name. And
well, how did you come to get signed by Capitol Records? Because I think this is an interesting story too.
Well, we played the first Atlanta Pop Festival, and that was part of what Terry Knight brought to the table, because his attorneys, who were doing the legal work for this festival, pitched the festival and told him they'd take a reduced rate if they would put their band on, you know, Terry's band on, Grand Funk Railroad, and let him open the show at noon. And they agreed to that, and we made it down to Atlanta, and we got up on that stage, and the people didn't want us to get off the stage, dude. I'm telling you, they loved what we were doing, and we played the first album on time. Plus, we put Land of a Thousand Dances, Wilson Pickett style, on the end, and I broke loose and was dancing around, and I had a $50 paisley print shirt on that was see-through, Ron. But this damn thing was sticking to me, and I mean, I was sweat. It was 110 degrees in the shade, Atlanta, Georgia, humid, and I was dying to death, and I just ripped this thing off, and the people jumped up to their feet, and they loved it, and I went, man, that worked. That worked right there. So from that point on, I would come out with like a vest on, and then by the second song, it was off, and I was bare-chested, because that's what they wanted to see, me with my armband on.
That's awesome. That's a crazy story. Now, I have to ask you, because as popular as this song became, I just, you know, doing the prep for this, I've listened to it at least 15 times, and I played it for my wife. She goes, oh, I know that song. Talk to me about writing I Am Your Captain closer to home. I'm fascinated with this song because it's almost like two songs in one. Talk about writing this song and how this song came to be.
I prayed for that song. I did, you know, I pray every night. Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. And then you bless all the people in the family, all your friends. God bless this one. God bless that one. And when I got to the end of blessing everybody, I put a P.S. on there and I said, Lord, would you please give me a song that would reach and touch the hearts of those you want to get to? I got up in the middle of the night and wrote the lyrics to I'm Your Captain. I didn't know it was a song, because I'm always writing, you know, things that don't turn out to be songs. Might be just a poem, might be just something, a thought, but I have it right next to my beds so that I can capture it, because I lost some of the best songs thinking, oh, I'll remember that till the morning, and then it was gone, dude. So anyways, I'm writing on my steno pad. And I know I can't go back to the top and reread what I've already written, because that would stop the flow. I was halfway between heaven and earth and in that state of being, and I'm writing this song. And it sounds kind of crazy to me as the words are coming to me. I'm writing them down. It sounds kind of crazy to me, you know. I wasn't putting any thought into it. I was just hearing the words, and I'm writing them down. And it wore me out doing that. I was so exhausted at the end of that session with the ink pen and the paper. I just put it on the nightstand, rolled back under the sheet, and went off into, you know, REM sleep, dude. I was deep into sleep. Got up in the morning, made coffee, and I'm out there in my kitchen looking at the horses out in the pasture. Grabbed my flat top, my acoustic guitar. I had a George Washburn, American-made George Washburn acoustic that was the most lovely sounding guitar. And I just started playing that. It was like, what? What is that? And then I hit that inversion of the C chord, and it chimed. It made these harmonics like I'd never hit that before. I went to hit the G, and I missed, and I hit a C instead. And wow, and that mistake woke me up to this inversion of a C chord that just, man, it was so melodic to me. It was very musical. And so I'm thinking, man, I got to remember this. And as I'm concentrating, oh, see, it's on that finger, this finger, that one, and then that string right there. And I thought, at that moment, go get the words. Oh, the words. Maybe this is a song. So I go in and I get those words, and I put them on the table, and I hit the recorder on my cassette recorder. I hit the red button and started playing it. And that's what I went to rehearsal with that day. And it became a great hit, a big hit, with a lot of people. I you know, as far as sharing with the guys that I prayed for that song, I didn't share it with them at that point. I just said, man, check this song out. And then as people would ask me, then, you know, I would tell this one, that one, this reporter. I'd be on a station doing an interview, and somebody said, well, how did you write that? And then I'm the same way I'm telling to you, Ron. I had the opportunity, and I've had lots of opportunities. That song came from love, and it went to the love inside of a lot of people.
It's very spiritual, no question.
It's and there's no video, brother, so it's what it is to whoever hears it. And a DJ friend of mine in New York City on WNEW told me they polled 100 different people, and they did this thing where they had them define what the song Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon and Garfunkel meant. He said, Farner, we got 100 diversely different definitions. There weren't even any two that were close. And that kind of blew my mind. But I appreciate it. I said, oh, man, it's our creativity. Our imagination is so much better. When you read a book and that person that reads the book goes to see the movie that was, you know, made after this book, they always say without fail, oh, the book was so much better than the movie.
Right.
You know why? Because it was our movie going on. It was feeding our imagination.
Theater of the mind is like what I like to call it.
Yes, yes. But we've been robbed of that with music videos. And I really never did like the music videos because they were enacting and they were depicting something that was coming from one guy or one gal, whoever was directing. And,
right.
You know, it couldn't be whatever you thought it was. It had to be what's in front of you. So it stifled music, in my humble opinion.
Yes. Well, I want to ask you specifically about the music. You know, one of my favorite, it's a trope in the 90s. It seemed in all those 90s movies there was a trope that someone would hear their song on the radio, and I've always loved that. It's like a couple movies. But I want to ask you: do you remember when and where you were when you heard "I Am Your Captain" closer to home on the radio for the first time?
No,
really?
Nope. Don't remember. I just remember we were on the road, and it was when. You know, I mean, AM radio was it when I was growing up.
Right.
And then when FM came on the scene, you'd have all these jocks that, you know, they were half smoked away or something, you know, half-baked brains. But they're playing long cuts, deep cuts, album cuts, and playing stuff nobody's ever heard before. And it was on one of those programs that I heard I'm Your Captain. And then after that, I can't even tell you how many jocks have thanked me, Ron, for that song. They said, because if I had to go to the bathroom, make a sandwich, have a smoke, I could get it all done with that song and get back yes. on the mic, you know.
That's funny. These young broadcasters, they don't know what it was like back in my day.
That's,
you know,
right.
It's all computerized now. Well, I have to move. I want to move along because I have yeah. to ask you about this. This to me is, and I didn't know this until I was doing research for this interview, Mark, but I'm fascinated with this because, and you mentioned videos. A lot of your videos come from the show. In 1971, you and your band sold out Shea Stadium.
Yeah.
Now, Ron, what's so big about that? Well, they did it faster than the Beatles did.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that legendary Shea Stadium show.
It was 71 hours, I think, was the actual figure. And it took the Beatles 2 weeks to sell it out. But part of our attraction to our brothers and sisters was, of course, the lyrics. There was no videos, but the lyrics meant so much to them. And there was hope in the lyrics. And we were the people's band at that point in time. We were the people's band, and we loved playing New York City, you know, playing Madison Square Garden. We did the Phoenix House there and sold it out three nights in a row and started seven drug rehabs in New York City. It was, you know, New York City loved us.
It's kind of interesting because a band from Flint, Michigan, you guys were just, New York just took you in as their own, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And I've always loved New York. I've always loved not just the restaurants. I mean, there's a lot of great restaurants, but there is a conglomeration of people there that have learned how to get along before all the horsey poo-poo started. but they, you know, they camped out on the lawn. And each ticket had to be purchased at the box office. This was right. long yeah. before any online ticket sales. So they had to be there in person picking up tickets. And
no CDC outlets.
That's right. That's right. So 55,000 people made it to the ticket office, brother. And
they were having a good time. If you watch some of those videos, there's kids just on top of the dugout, just, and it's rocking. I mean, the whole stadium yeah. was rocking. What was that like from your perspective to get that kind of energy in that environment? Because you're not talking about a little club. This is Shea Stadium. What is it even possible to get that emotion when you guys are in the middle of the field? How was that?
Yeah, I mean, it's concentrated because Shea Stadium was a half circle. You know, it was like second base was the focal point of that half circle as right. far as the audible, what you could hear from the audience. And when they were singing with me, getting closer to my home, it's like, man, I had a hard time holding back the tears. My emotions were so high and my heart was just beating out of my chest. When we flew over the stadium and Humble Pie was on stage there at second base, we saw the physical flexing of that wow. you see in the videos of that. You could see it from the helicopter just plain as day. And I'm going, oh, my God. I start praying, God, please don't let that fall down. Don't let it fall down. Hold it up.
That's awesome. That's yeah, awesome. Man. Is there any better feeling as a musician when you're getting that kind of feedback from a crowd, wherever it is? I mean, that has to be. You talk about the Holy Spirit because I know you're a Christian. But
yeah.
music brings that, too. Music brings that inside of you. And, I mean, I'm not even a musician, and if I hear certain music, it hits me.
Yes. Yes, it is emotional. And it comes in waves, depending on the song, depending on where you're at in the song. but waves of emotion. And I'm very sensitive to that part of my senses. And it picks me up. It's like, I don't know if my feet ever were on the stage that night, Brother Ron. Mm-hmm. Seriously, I was floating on the love of the people. And they didn't come there to boo and hiss. They came there to lift up their band and to egg us on and to, you know, to root for us and to holler. And man, it was working. What a great, you know, that memory, just talking to you about it, dude, I got goosebumps.
I believe it.
Yeah.
I believe it.
I got it.
And they were feeling, and that's what's so special about it, is all these people were moved by your music, and they were feeling it that night in any of those videos. Now, I want to move on. In 1972, Craig Frost joined as a fourth member. Why and how did this come to be?
The other two guys wanted a fourth member. I believe it was for Brewer to write music with, because he would ask me, do I have words for this song? And I say, yes, I have words for this song. Some of them I didn't have words for, like I Can Feel Them in the Morning. That's a Brewer Farner song. Shining On, that's a Brewer Farner song. And when we did American Band, you know, I wrote the chord changes. I did the cowbell was my idea. The drum lick on the intro was my drum lick. And I had a lot to do with that song. But Brewer says, after we cut it down at Miami Beach, he says, Mark, I've never had 100% song right on any song. Do you think I could take it on this one? I said, go ahead. You know, I gave him my half because I'm a nice guy. And even though some people think I've been misused by that other part, them guys are just off their track for, I don't know for how long. I don't know if it's temporary or permanent, but they're off their track. And they'll get back to love at some point. And that's what the band really was about, was the music was about the love.
Right.
We were about the love. Mel and I were partners. We really did a lot together. We were tight friends. But, you know, as some people say, you know, try to put the husband and wife back together.
Right.
That's been divorced, you know, because people ask me all the time, you guys ever going to get back together? I say, well, it's not because I wouldn't do it, because I've always said for 24 years now, if they wanted to get back together, we'd just go back together and split it three ways and make a lot of money and satisfy a world full of people. Because, I mean, we got fans all over the world.
Well, I have faith. I have faith. And I'll tell you what, and I don't know if you're familiar with one of my favorite. It's one of my favorites because it was one of the first shows I saw, was Triumph. And if those guys in recent years have come together, but there was a lot of bad blood between them. So there's faith. People will come back. It'll happen. Yes, Craig Frost joined as the fourth member, but I want to ask you, is it true that Peter Frampton was someone you guys considered to come in as a fourth member? Because that's a big name.
Well, we had only talked about it between us guys. We never... I don't know how it got out to the general public, because that was just a consideration. And really, Don had spoken with Craig, and I think they had already written a song or two. So it was just in passing.
Now, earlier you mentioned you were talking about the American Band, and this is actually, I have this a couple questions down, but it's something I have to ask you. I've always been fascinated with bands that have multiple singers. You know, you have Night Ranger, Genesis. Triumph. I mentioned Triumph.
Yeah.
When you guys, obviously, when you were writing songs, how did you guys determine who was going to sing it? And was how what was that process like? Because like you said, you kind of helped write an American Band, but, you know, he essentially got the credit. But when you guys are coming together and say, okay, this is a song now, how do you determine who sings it?
Well, I would bring most of the songs. I'm like 92% of them I brought. So a couple of times, like on Are You Ready from the first On Time album, first Grand Funk album. I thought, man, what a great thing if Brewer could sing this and I could be on stage running back and forth, entertaining, you know, throwing my guitar around and what have you, you know, being a front man. And so Brewer sang it on the album. He also sang Shining On because he wrote those lyrics. And Black Licorice, we co-wrote Shining On, Black Licorice, but he came with the lyrics, so he sang them. And most of the time, that's the way it was.
Right.
Except for I Can Feel Them in the Morning and Are You Ready?
Now, before we move on from American Band, because that was a number one song, but I'm not going to ask you about that. What I want to ask you about is because you mentioned there's not a lot of videos. I think there is a video for that. And it's interesting because you guys are riding motorcycles around a field. You're walking around a barn. And it's obviously pre-MTV, pre any kind of, you know, template that you would have to make a music video. Where was that filmed and what did you guys have in mind for that video?
It was filmed in Parshallville, Michigan. I owned 190 acres, which encompassed half of the mill pond that was in Parshallville. And the fields, I cut the hay for the horses. They were already planted to hay. And we all would go out, and we had these three-wheelers that big toys for big boys, and we would just tear shit up. I mean, just tear it up and have a ball riding these things. And then I, you know, had that TC-125 Suzuki. It had low range and high range, so you could kick it into low range and go off-road with it, and it was, you know, low gear, so you could climb any hill or you could climb trees with that thing. But the Brewer had a Bull Taco, and Melvin had, I forget what he had, a BSA, I think it was it. And we're out riding there, and Lynn Goldsmith comes out. She says, I want to film this. I want to film you guys doing this kind of stuff. And I want to take a picture of you guys up in your hay mow of that old barn naked. And I go, and she said, she told us what she wanted. She said, I want you laying down. I am not laying down in the hay naked, you know, face down in the hay. I got to have some britches on because man, I know what hay feels like. I put it up there every year.
You don't want
year.
That up your butt.
That's right, man. Exactly. So Lynn Goldsmith shot the whole thing, you know, they videoed it. And she was like the director of all of that. And she was the one that came up with shipping it gold. It was gold. The first 100,000 albums were all yellow vinyl. And Lynn Goldsmith did a lot for the band as far as conceptual album covers. Right. She did the Shining On with the 3D glasses. She did, you know, All the Girls in the World Beware with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Franco Colombo, their bodies.
Yeah.
Born to Die, Us in the Coffins. Yeah, she had a lot to do with the image. She was hired to be a publicist, but she was more like a co-manager.
Now, when she was filming, was it specifically for the video, or was she just capturing what you guys were doing, having a good time?
Well, it was good. We knew that it was going to be put together as some kind of presentation, and there was a lot of footage shot, and there was some of it that didn't make it. But I
like the footage of you in the canoe. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I love that. Was what that mill pond? That man, I'm telling you what, I caught some big pike out of there, monsters.
Oh, by the way, I have a trick to get those bones out of pikes. I'm a big fan of pike. All right, no.
All right.
I have to ask you, after you know, an American Band, you guys had some hit songs with Bad Time and Some Kind of Wonderful. Talk about what those two songs did for Grand Funk.
Well, Bad Time was played more than any other song in 1975. And I got a BMI award for that particular song. Even though it didn't go to number one, it got played more than the one that did go to number one did. And I think it was because at that time, it was before the deregulation of the FCC, and a 777 rule was still in effect. You could own 7 AM, 7 FM, 7 television stations, as you recall, Ron. And a lot of people were calling in. I mean, millions of people were calling in to hear that song. And that's how it got played more than any other song. I mean, and there was a lot of guys have come up to me since then, as you can imagine, and thanked me for that song. Oh, I was going through the same kind of stuff in my life, man. That was my song. And a lot of girls thanking me for that song, you know.
Did you know it was going to be a hit when you were writing it?
I didn't. I liked the song, but I thought Some Kind of Wonderful was going to be a hit just because of the way it comes out of the box. And Jimmy Einer, he was great with vocals. He really... he did, and even on Bad Time, I mean, the vocals are right there. The harmonies are right there in your face. You have no trouble understanding what the song is saying. With Some Kind of Wonderful, we would listen to, you know, this is back when it was AM radio and Skip would come in after 11 o'clock at night. You could listen to John R. way down south in Dixie at WLAC, Nashville, Tennessee. And he's playing all this stuff, you know, the blues and the things that we would set up and listen to. Anyways, we listened to Some Kind of Wonderful when it was the Soul Brothers 6 out of Philadelphia, but it was a regional hit in Michigan. We thought the whole country was hearing it, but it wasn't. It was just played around, you know, Flint and Ann Arbor, Detroit area. And we would warm up with that song on the way to gigs. And we're in the back of a limo. I don't need a whole lot of money. You know, it was like, and the manager sitting up in the front seat, he rolls down the window one night and he said, man, what is that song you guys keep doing? And you know, we said, hey, man, it's Soul Brothers 6, Some Kind of Wonderful. He says, you guys need to record that thing. He says, you really need to record that damn thing. And so we, okay, let's do it. And it just happened to be when Einer was doing the producing, and he's a great producer, great guy. What a smile on that guy. He smiles, and the whole room is full of teeth.
Right. takes over the room with their presence, right?
Yeah.
Now, I Grand Funk Railroad, very successful, obviously makes you a household name. You're one of the most popular bands in the United States. But in the late 70s, you went solo, signed with Atlantic, recorded, I think, Mark Farner in 77, No Frills in 78. Talk about the transition of going out on your own from a musical perspective. How did that change things for you?
Well, when Brewer came to the studio that day and said he had to find something more stable to do with his life, it blew our mind. But I knew he was serious. He was an hour and a half late getting to rehearsal, and he was never late for anything. We were just about ready to start calling the sheriff's office and see if there was an accident and he was involved in or something.
Just wasn't like him, yeah.
Yeah, just wasn't like him. But when he walked in and he told us he was going to have to find something more stable to do with his life, I said, are you serious?
We have hit songs on the radio. What's more stable than that?
Yeah, he says, I'm out of here, and he left. And so I start calling right then. I start calling Dennis Bellinger, Rick Baker, Al Watton, drums, start putting a band together, my brother Ricky, and we went out. I did that first album that you mentioned, Mark Farner, and then No Frills on Atlantic, both of those albums were on Atlantic Records, but the guy who signed me was the vice president, and he got fired from Atlantic before my first release. So the guy that was in my corner kind of, I didn't have
that's
a corner
not good
anymore.
Not good.
No. But we were out doing those songs as well as my Grand Funk writing And people were happy that I was out there, even though they miss Grand Funk. Sure. I mean, they take the guy that wrote 92% of the songs.
Right.
And we had some great success.
Now, talk about, because this is fascinating to me, how do you go, talk about the transition from writing and performing rock and roll music and then going to Christian music. Why, when, and how did this transformation take place for you as an artist?
It happened in the early 80s. My wife had left me, and our two boys. It was just me and the kids. At that time, we had two sons, and I was down in the dumps, dude. I was way down in the dumps, and one day I was sitting there. I was about halfway through a 12-pack, and I was sitting at the dining room table, and the kids were in watching some kind of cartoons or something, and over in the corner of this log cabin that we had built there with the help of some friends, there was a picture, a leaded glass picture of a pheasant, and the sun was coming through there. And I'm looking at that picture because the way the sun was hitting it, the eye of the pheasant was red, and it was like almost blinding me. And I looked over, and I saw, in that corner of the room, I saw myself 9 years old when my dad died. Billy Graham was doing a crusade in Flint, Michigan, and he was at Atwood Stadium. And I went from the dining room where I left my mourning and crying relatives who were trying to console my mother. My mother was losing it, but my aunts and uncles and grandpa, you know, they were all trying to calm her down, and I just couldn't be around that. So I walk into the living room, and my dad, before he died, he just bought our first television. It was black and white. But Billy Graham was doing this crusade. And as I'm walking by, he says, "Are you hurting?" I kind of stopped and I looked.
Like he was talking to you directly.
Yeah, dude. And he says, "Are you hurting? Do you need a touch from God?" And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, man, are you kidding me? I'm looking at this dude, and he says, "Come over here and put your hand on the television." And I walked over, and I put my hand on that television, and, brother, I prayed and received Jesus Christ as my Savior right that day. But I went on and through my life. I never went to any churches. I always thought the churches were kind of phony, and, you know, I just never got into that religious stuff. I got into the Lord. I got into love. I read the Bible. I got to know who Jesus was. But in 1985, after I received my answer to my prayer, I had prayed with this old pastor in an AOG church in Onaway, Michigan. And I told him, I said, "My wife left me. I want her back. I don't care. I'm willing to forgive her for, you know, whatever she's done. I don't even care. I just want her back. I love her and I miss her. And, you know, we got two sons here." He says, and I ask him, "Can you pray to God and ask him to give her back to me?" And he says, "You pray and I'll agree." So just in my words, I prayed, asked God to bring my wife back to me. And that day, in another city 50 miles away, she prayed and she received Jesus Christ as her Lord and Savior the same day I prayed. I mean, there's your sign.
Yeah. Well, and you're gonna have to tell me from her perspective, what was making her do that? That's an interesting.
She was walking across the street to go into the park, and some friends of ours, Pete and Connie, they were driving down the street, and they saw her, and they said, "That's Lisa Farner." And they didn't know that we were separated. But they pulled over, "Hey, Lisa." And then she got in their car, and she was crying, telling them. And they prayed with her.
Wow.
They prayed with her. And so I was at the studio downstate, and I found out, this is like 2 days later, I'm downstate, I found out that she had given her life to the Lord. And then when we got back together, you know, we just celebrated 45 years on January 8th. And we're together here for the duration because love is, it's equal between us. I esteem her to be equal with me.
I love
that. And that's how love operates. You can't have a hierarchy in a relationship. You got to be both. You got to be king and queen.
Your first prayer was answered. Tenfold, by the way.
Tenfold, brother.
Wow. You know, as long I have to share this with you because this is one of my favorite pieces of testimony, and I don't share this with very much, but in 08, I was working for Comerica Park. I was teaching at Specs Howard. I was working full-time covering a trial for WJR. And in a matter of 3 weeks, that's when the economy took a dive. In a matter of 3 weeks, I went down. I lost all the jobs except I had part-time at JR. I ended up going to visit my dad in Nashville because my mom had died a year before, and I wanted to spend some time with my father. I was like, I'm not working. Might as well go to Nashville. And while we were there, we went to my dad's church, and there was a cancer survivor giving his testimony. Mark, I had $43 left in my pocket. I gave it all to the collection plate. I get home that afternoon. There's a check from WJR for a couple thousand waiting for me that I didn't even know I had coming. 4 days later, I got a job offer at a radio station in Fort Smith, Arkansas. God is good.
Oh, man. Oh, man.
And I don't believe any of that would have happened had I not taken all of my money that I had to my name and put it in that collection plate.
Yeah, well, you can't outgive God, Brother Ron.
That's true.
And as long as you are giving, you'll always have something to give. And look, we're not going to be here, you know, for eternity, but people are kind of trained to think that way. We could collect all this stuff, and when we die, man, if we got a barn full of toys, somebody else is going to be breaking them toys. You know, it's not going to be us.
So let's get back to your musician, as a musician. How do you... Was it different writing Christian music, or you knew this is from, I'm going to write Christian music, I'm done with rock and roll, or was it, because I'm sure that rock and roll had an influence on the Christian writing, no?
Oh, yeah, it's not Christian music, although some of it encompasses the Christian, what I was taught in the Christian church, but some of that was dead wrong. Once I made the escape, and I made it into heaven, and I was shown the problem of debt consciousness on earth, then I knew. But it's God rock, and God is love. And it's love, to love the people of this earth enough to give them the truth in the face of people, you know, this religious stuff. Man. They think they know what it is, but that's... You run into the pride of man, which is this worst downfall, because the ego will defend the pride of people. And it's very hard for most people to admit that they've made a mistake.
And be vulnerable. They have to allow themselves to be vulnerable.
Yes, yes, brother. Even in the churches. And I, in my mind and the way I see things, the churches that have signed a 501c3 tax exempt status, and they tell their crowd, hold up your checkbooks, hold up your wallet, hold up your money, and then they get them all whooped up and pass the plates. That's going against the word of God in 2 Corinthians, where it says, don't give if someone is compelling you to give. Don't give. Give from a cheerful heart, for God loves a cheerful giver. And that in itself, that's one big bad for me, when somebody passes the plate. That's a no, 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 no. And tithing is another no, no, no. But when you sign a 501c3 tax exemption, you give men the authority over a ministry that you are supposed to be representing God and the Word of God and the... You know, how can you, and especially these men, the Infernal Revenue Service, the tax collectors for the families that own the Federal Reserve, for eight families who control 189. Do you know that there's only three countries in this world that are not controlled by them and don't have the central bank? And that is right. Iran, North Korea, and Cuba. The rest, even Russia, is they got to bow the knee to that central bank. And they're just men that own the central bank. But these men that are just men are inventing money. They print it out of thin air because they have nothing to back it up. And they're trying to push this digital stuff. That's why they're running every currency into the ground. It's like right. a race to the bottom, Ron, so they can then come to our rescue with this digital way of, and you'll have nothing and love it. Kiss my badonkadonk. I don't think this way. I do not think this way. You know, this is where you have to stand up as a man for the freedom and for the sake of freedom, because the United States is the last hope for the entire world. We really don't realize because we've been spoiled. You know, we're kind of fickle to the way right. we've had it. But if you've traveled the world, like God has given me the grace to do, and the experience of other countries and to see how they live, man, we've had it so good. And we have our guns, yeah. and all these yeah. other countries don't. And the reason they're coming so heavy after our guns is because it's the same ones who took them away from the people in England, in Australia, in New Zealand. It took it's wherever the guns are absent, it's because these people control the finances of those countries.
And what's funny about that is we don't have to go off on it. But here's the thing. If you could wave a wand and make all the guns disappear, maybe we can have this discussion.
Yeah.
But as long as these people who are making the rules are walking around with people guarding them with guns.
Yeah, buddy.
Stay away from mine.
Yeah.
That's how I feel.
Yeah, brother.
Because yeah. drugs are illegal, but they're still around. I mean, that thought, like, I don't understand people that are into gun control, that they just don't get that. That guns are in existence.
Yes. I'm with you on that. And my friend, CIA, he's living down in Central America now. He told me, because he was working that whole thing in Panama when the, you know, Noriega and that whole thing went down. Right. He said, back then he told me, he says, Farner, he said, the CIA is in business to ensure enough drugs get into our big cities to ruin our country. And I'm thinking, what are you telling me this? This can't be real. This is America. But dude, look at what's happened.
Yeah, it's quite bizarre.
And the drugs. Yeah, the drugs have really
fentanyl helped. Right now is just killing people. It's crazy.
Oh my God, dude. Oh my God. Yes.
All right. So I want to move along because I could because me and you it sounds like we're in lockstep a lot of this stuff. But I want to ask you because if you haven't done enough Grand Funk Railroad, you go off and you start making Christian music and that's going
God
well.
Rock.
God Rock, yes, God Rock.
Yeah, man.
But in 1994, and this is another thing that I think is really cool. I mean, you talk about, you know, when we're on our deathbed thinking back of cool things. You toured with the Ringo Starr's All-Stars for a while. I want to ask you because you were with John and Twistle, Billy Preston, Randy Bachman. What was this experience like for you? That had to be cool.
It was 95, Brother Ron, and it was the coolest thing. I mean, because Billy Preston used to open for Grand Funk, and I would go out and I would watch Billy Preston every night. I loved that guy. I loved his persona. I loved the way he presented himself. I loved his voice, and he a virtuoso on the keyboard. When we're in rehearsal for Ringo, here's Preston. He's got the Bible in his left hand. He's reading the Bible, playing his part, and singing, and looking over, and I mean, I couldn't do one of the things. I mean, he's doing three or four things at one time. I love that guy. God rest his soul. And John Entwistle. He was, we became great friends during that tour. He was a wonderful man. He had a wonderful heart. And with Zach Starkey drumming, monster drummer. when Ringo called me and he says, I'm not going to be drumming on this tour. He says, my son, Zach, will be drumming. And I said, oh, awesome. You know, and then and we had from BTO, Randy Bachman.
Yes.
And we rehearsed up there in Canada, just outside of Randy's stomping grounds. He lives on the island offshore, but in Vancouver there. It was great getting to know them and, you know, going into rehearsal there. And then we'd you know, lock into these songs. And then Ringo would come in. And Ringo came up to the apartment that I was staying in with my family. I had my two sons at the time and my wife. And Ringo came in and introduced himself to the family and how you doing and everything. You know, it was really good to know that he was just a common guy, but you know, he's a Beatle,
right?
And the poor guy could put a baseball cap on and sunglasses, and he looks like Ringo with a baseball cap and sunglasses.
He's not fooling anybody.
But you know, we Felix Cavalieri, we became great friends during that tour. And also Mark Rivera, God, what a great, you know, for a he like a multitasking guy. He did percussion back on the congas. He blew the saxophone. He's playing guitar back there, doing background vocals. A great guy, and he doesn't get enough mention. But all of those guys working together, Ringo told us that we were the best.
Wow.
All-star band that he'd worked with, and I appreciate that. And it, you know, he put on a thing on YouTube saying, don't send me anything to be autographed. I'm no longer signing autographs. Don't send things in the mail to me. That you're not going to get them back. They're going in the trash. And he was kind of adamant about what he was saying to the people. But I could see after being with him, you know, why he was that way.
Right.
And just going over to Japan where we started the tour, we're up there in first class, and these people are coming up, they're sending their kids up to Ringo to get stuff signed for them.
Wow.
And Ringo, he just like, hey, shut this stuff down. Shut it down. I have to have some peace. At some point in time, when we were doing this PR thing in Japan, in Tokyo, it was a press conference, and we were sitting at a table up on this stage, this big long table, and the band was sitting, you know, in line down away from Ringo. Ringo was sitting right in the middle, kind of like the Last Supper, and Ringo is sitting in the middle. And this gal comes up to me, and she said, I want to ask Mr. Farner a question, and I stood up and I said, what is it, honey? And she said, what is it like playing with Beatle? And so I said to her, I said, listen, and point over at Ringo. I said, Ringo puts his pants on one leg at a time, just like I do. And he stands up, comes over. Thank you, brother. Thank you, brother. And he gives me a big hug because I recognized him for just being one of us.
I can't
just
imagine what it would be like going through life where everybody just kisses your ass.
Yeah. Yeah, buddy. Absolutely.
He will always have a special place in my heart because, I mean, I was born in 69, so I was a youngster when the Beatles were happening. My first exposure to Ringo Starr was when we got cable in 1980 and Caveman was on HBO all the time. I love that movie. I still watch it every once in a while, Caveman, Ringo Starr.
Yeah, man.
Go ahead.
Not to mention his drumming style.
Yes.
Are you kidding me?
Not enough love for his drumming.
Woo!
He was the Beatle. He was the Beatle.
Yeah.
But 95 was a big free year for you because also in 95, if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that when you guys got back with the original two members of Grand Funk and did a little reunion tour? Talk about that.
We started that in 96, right after I had the operation on my neck. I went to the Rock Doc, Paul McCombs, Nashville, Tennessee, And he brings in a little bottle with him. I had vertebrae C6 and C7 back here fused together. He brings in a little bottle. He says, in this bottle, and it's got like it's a bone
right
in formaldehyde. He said, we're going to put this between your vertebrae. I looked at that. I said, you're going to put that thing between my vertebrae? You know, he says, no, dude, we are going to whittle it down. We're going to make it fit. And I went, oh, phew. He says, but there's only one thing. He says, I don't know whether this is male or female, this bone. He says, you could be part woman when we get done with you. I said, yeah. Well, thanks, buddy. Appreciate you letting me know that. He had long, his ponytail was longer than mine. And he said, what do you want to listen to? I said, listen, dude, I hope I'm out cold. I don't want to know about what's going on. Because especially he told me he's going through the front to get to the back. And he says, well, I'm going to blast some Grand Funk. They call him the Rock Doc. And he just, when he's operating, to get in the zone, he has to have it loud and boom.
I love that.
Then he can go there. Then he can go there. It blocks out everything else, and he can do what he needs to do. We're still friends today. But he told me there's no more Stratocasters, no more Telecasters, no more Les Pauls, no more Les Paul Jr. I'm thinking, stop, you're killing me. You are killing every guitar I got. And when I was in Japan with Ringo, I had gone over to Korg to try some of their new stomp boxes, some of their guitar effects, and I've been endorsing Korg for years. And they brought out a Parker Fly. They said, have you ever seen a Parker Fly? I said, I never heard of a Parker Fly. He hands it to me, and I go, wow, there's that. What is that made of, balsa wood? Well, it all came back to me when the Rock Doc said, no more Tellies, no more Strats. No, you know. So I got a hold of Ken Parker, Larry Fishman, God bless him. They set me up with Parker guitars, and I've been playing Parker ever since. And, man, I am so glad I made the switch. The one that I've been playing since 96, I call her baby, there's no fret wear. I've never had to do another setup on it. It's had the same setup for all these years. It stays in tune. It's got some Purcell tuning keys on it, and I love it. It gives me room to play.
I see. I feel you. So when you guys reunited, you guys played three sold-out shows to benefit Bosniev, I believe, joined by Paul Schaefer. This is another all-star lineup I got to ask you about. Paul Schaefer was with you. Alto Reed, Peter Frampton, Howard Eddy Jr. From this, you guys released a live two-disc benefit CD that was recorded at the Palace of Auburn Hills, of all places. Could you talk about experience?
Yes, and, you know, with Paul Schaefer being the band leader, it was great because he told me his favorite song of all time is Bad Time to Be in Love. And so he said, I have some.
That's high praise coming from him.
Yeah, man. I hugged him, didn't want to let go. But he says, you know, he's got a special way he wants me to give it the okay. And man, when he, you know, brought in the horns and everything on it, wow. It was great. And to work not only with the Alto Reed, God rest his soul, and Frampton, we took it to New York City, and Leslie West was our special guest in New York City, and we took it to L.A., and Slash and Billy Preston were our special guests in L.A., and so they came out and jammed with us, and it was badass. I loved that whole thing with Paul Schaefer leading these orchestras and putting it, because my thing, as soon as we released I'm Your Captain, I'm thinking, oh man, it would be so great to do this song with an orchestra and play all of those parts, you know? Yeah. And so it finally came to fruition in 1996.
Wow. What a cool experience. Now, I have to ask you, and Brian Pastoria mentioned it earlier, you tell me about the Guitar Army. What was this, and how did this, I mean, you talk about playing with a lot of great, in addition to Brian, you played with Chad Smith. Talk about the Guitar Army and how that came to be and how that.
Well, Bob Bauer was in on that, and he was a
DJ.
A
DJ Bob Bauer?
Yes.
Oh, I got to meet him. Wonderful man.
A wonderful man and a Vietnam veteran himself. And this was for the Vietnam veterans, and because it was, all of us guys, the musicians that made it there, Dick Wagner, you know, we had who was it from MC5, Rob Tyner, oh my God, sang his ass off that night, And we had people, you know, from local bands, too, from the Rationals, Scott Morgan up there. And we had so many, just the camaraderie, because it was all of us guys were doing it for free.
Right.
Nobody was getting paid for this. Randy California came in to do it. You know, all of these people just brought together for the love that was in our hearts for our brothers and sister Vietnam veterans, and that lifted the whole place. I've never experienced anything since then that was in a small, you know, Harpo's is not that big, although they had a great stage and it was a wonderful presentation. It's not like playing Cobo Hall,
right.
You know, but the energy was like playing Cobo Hall. It was so great. Gary Spaniola was there. You know, these people that are still friends of mine today, still playing, still making music. For me to, you know, think back of it, I wish we could have took that show on the road. Mm. All those people, man, that would have been a great from city to city to city bus tour. Yeah. Oh man, that could have made a lot of people happy.
Well, I know you playing makes people happy, and that's what I want to ask you about next. Both as a member of Grand Funk Railroad, and as a solo artist, you've been inducted into the Michigan Rock and Roll Legends Hall of Fame. What does that honor mean to you, if anything?
Well, it means to me, I really don't care about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, even though it'd be nice to be in there. I know who's running it. I know it's political. I know there's a lot of people that are in it that don't even deserve to be in it. And there's a lot of people that are not in it that do deserve to be in it.
Foreigner. So, Grand Funk Railroad. Foreigner. Grand Funk Railroad. Those are my two.
But to be honored, and, you know, from Michiganders, from my home state, my brothers and sisters, from my stomping grounds, that means the world to me. It does. It is an honor, and the people that put it together, and because they see the need, and that's not only there, John Ellison, who wrote Some Kind of Wonderful, was inducted into the West Virginia Hall of Fame, and he had me come down there, because we're friends, he had me come down there and present him with his award.
That's cool.
And with a lot of West Virginians, and I got to sing Some Kind of Wonderful with the guy that wrote it. He gave me the second verse, and, you know, it's a camaraderie, and it's like he says it the same way I do. Are you kidding me? Pinch me. Is this shit real?
You know, just hearing that song, if that doesn't put you in a good mood, you're not human.
Yeah, there you go.
Another one you were talking about, I meant to ask you about this earlier, and I keep hating to drop Brian Pastoria's name, but we've had conversations about this. He introduced me to We the Kingdom, that Christian band. Have you heard of them?
No.
They sing this song called Child of Love and Holy Water.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
he sent me that song.
Yeah, we were talking about you singing that with someone else, and I thought that would be good. That would be very, very good.
Yeah.
I also
think Alice Cooper.
Oh yes, Alice Cooper, another one, another Detroit. Yeah, he grew up in East Detroit, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Well, Brian was saying that Alice and I should do that song.
Yes, yes, I would love to see, because I mean,
Alice are great people. Yeah, great people.
Well, what's interesting is specifically about the music, and that's why I got into radio to begin with. I like to share music. In fact, when Silk Sonic came out, I shared that with so many people because I was a huge fan. But the whole, when I can introduce new music to somebody, that just fills me with spiritual, you know, feelings. And
yeah.
And when he turned me on to that music, because I'm not normally someone who listens to God rock, as you would call it. But yeah, man, music is transcendent, and especially when it's Christian music or it touches your soul, rather for, you know, in the name of Jesus Christ. Yeah. That's even better, if you ask me. I don't know.
Yeah, it is. It is.
One bad thing that I have to ask you about. It's really not anything that you could control, but I hate to even ask you about it, because if it happened to me, I'd be irate. But I read somewhere that in the 2008 Universal fire, a lot of the original Grand Funk Railroad material was destroyed. Is that true?
I couldn't tell you one way or the other on that, no. Brother Ron.
You didn't hear anything about that, or no? Or no?
No.
Okay. Because that just seems like a criminal to me. That should be in the Smithsonian, if you ask me. The music you guys were making. Coming back full circle, because this is called Radio Days, and I asked you about what you were listening to as a youngster, and I know it's not going to be a good answer, but in your opinion, in 2023, what is your take on terrestrial radio today?
Terrestrial radio, we commonly refer to as shit radio, because it turned to shit when it went to the corporate conglomerates,
yeah,
who have limited, you know, if you got some guy sitting in New York City programming 4,500 stations.
Yeah.
He's a program director for 4,500. They're playing the same thing. You can go from state to state to state on that tour bus, and I could tell you the next song in rotation because they all got the same playlist. It's turned sterile. They won't play songs that we play on stage. And because they won't, I throw in, sometimes I do Ohio, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
Great tune.
Just to keep people aware, because they're not hearing it, you know, on the radios. They're not hearing Buffalo Springfield for what it's worth. Like we used to play that stuff. It was mainstream FM radio. Now they've kind of, when you own all of this, the stations, and you're the families, the eight families that control all the money in 189 countries, you control the narrative in all of these various countries. People wanted to know. I've heard people say, how the hell did this happen? COVID broke out. It was like worldwide. Yeah. When you got the narrative worldwide, you can make stuff happen. It's horsey poo-poo, worldwide horsey poo-poo, and that's why, you know, I call it shit radio, because that's what it is.
Couple more questions real quick. I want to ask you this, and I meant to ask you this earlier. Have you been approached by people that came after you and said, oh my gosh, you totally inspired me, and if so, could you name drop?
Well, I know Prince was inspired. And said in interviews, mentioned my name specifically and Grand Funk Railroad.
Wow.
And
another underrated guitar player, Prince. I mean, let's be honest.
Oh my God! Yeah, yeah. Wow. You talk about creative. Oh my God. And Eddie Van Halen, God rest his soul. He called me when we were playing at the Greek Theater, and we were doing that show out there with the orchestra. Eddie called. He wanted to be there, but his wife was sick and he was staying home. I said, God bless you, man, for staying home with your wife. Man, that speaks volumes of your character. I love you. You know, some great people have confessed being influenced by me personally and the band Grand Funk Railroad.
I'm going to put you on the spot here, Mark. In your opinion, and you've had a—I mean, I'm sure you'd be the first to admit you've had a charmed life. Do you have a favorite memory from your musical career? I mean, it's still ongoing, so I mean, it's not a fair thing, but I mean,
yeah. Well, walking on stage, Atlanta, Georgia, the first Atlanta Pop Festival. It was the second gig we played as Grand Funk Railroad. The first gig was at the Hamburg County Fair up by Buffalo, New York, in a big tent. The second was in front of 185,000 people in Atlanta, Georgia. It was a sea of people, Brother Ron. I looked out, and it was just to the horizon, it was people. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, do I ever have to pee? Oh, my God.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. What's next? What's next for Mark Farner?
You know, my musicians are great musicians. My bass player came after I cut the album with Alice Cooper and Wayne Kramer and Johnny Badanjic, and Paul Randolph played bass. I'd never even heard of Paul before, but when we did that session and I got to play music with him and I got to sing background vocals with him on the same microphone, you're getting pretty close, and I'm listening to him, and I asked him if he'd be willing to, you know, play some shows with us, and being that he's a Detroit boy, yeah, man, he says. So glad to have Paul with me. Glad to have Hubert Crawford, who played with James Brown. I met him at a show we did in Montgomery, Alabama. It was War, Grand Funk, and James Brown and a street festival. And you talk about a rocking crowd. Oh, my God, brother. Yeah. And the keyboard player, Mark Hoyt, he's out of St. Augustine, Florida. He's a monster. He sings, he plays, he's a great guy. He's funnier than a crowd. I'm telling you, everything that he is associated with has some stem of humor in it. So
that's great.
Great guys to be together with. And of course, my wife Lisa, she'll go with us sometimes and sell the merchandise, and it's all USA made stuff. I won't sell anything. In fact, if you found a piece of merchandise that had my name on it and was made in a foreign country, you know it's a bootleg.
Mark, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story. It's been an honor. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure, Brother Ron. God bless you. God bless your show. Keep on doing it. All for love.
Thanks again to Mark, and thank you for tuning in to Radio Days, the podcast. Today's show is produced by Ron Robinson Studios. If you need professional marketing videos, professional photography, headshots, maybe you need drone video, head over to ronrobinsonstudios.com. You can also hear previous episodes of Radio Days, the podcast, there as well. Also, as I mentioned earlier in the show, if you'd like to learn more about the upcoming documentary series about the history of radio, Radio Days, 101 Years of Radio, click on Radio Days, the movie, under the documentaries tab at ronrobinsonstudios.com. Thanks for checking out the show. Hope you enjoyed it. Until next time.
You can't go. All the plants are going to die.